Well, first, let me ask you about The Barber of Seville, since it's going to be on the screens around the country and, of course, live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. And what do you think, first of all, what do you think accounts for the enduring popularity of this opera, of The Barber of Seville?
I think it should absolutely endure the test of time. It's a great piece, musically, theatrically. It's very family friendly, which is, of course, incredibly helpful to keeping a piece alive from generation to generation, because we need to bring the kids to it so that they can bring their children to it. It's a very accessible piece. The story is easy to follow. And the music is really pleasing. And, you know, everybody loves a good love story with a lot of comedic elements. And I think that's really what I think those are the strengths that will last.
Well, the Met produced that reminds me that about how the Met produced an English language version of the opera a couple of years ago that you sang in.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear about or meet any new, perhaps younger fans that you may have referenced who were enticed by this idea of hearing the opera in English at that time?
Absolutely. There were lots of schools of thought on it. You know, there are opera purists who aren't exactly in love with the idea of translating certain operas, but then there are other people who really appreciate it. It gives them a different perspective on a piece. You know, it allows them to come in, hear it in their own native language, which takes us one step closer, I think, into the story, purely on an accessible front, if that makes any sense. Everybody has their own thoughts about pieces being translated, but I think that particularly, again, with The Barber of Seville, it's a great opera, and at this time, for the arts in general, it's really important for us to do what we can to bring in new audiences and to really educate the younger audiences, the, you know, teens and tweens and all that, and even young children, because the theater is a magical place no matter what. And whether it's opera or musical theater, ballet or just acting, you know, it's a really wonderful place and everybody really enjoys it. So no matter what, I think if we can just bring the audience in, let's do it in English. Let's do it in Chinese. I don't care. Let's just do it.
So Rossini's score for The Barber of Seville, it calls for a contralto voice in its original writing for Rossina. And mezzo-sopranos like yourself have been singing the role for many years. How do you prepare yourself and your voice for the role and its particularities?
Well, somebody asked this of me recently. They said, you know, is there any specific training that you do to sing coloratura? I don't specifically do anything out of the norm in order to sing this rep. It's something that I've always enjoyed singing. And as a technician, no matter what repertoire we sing, we all have to undergo pretty much the same training. And you have to get your technique right, you know, produce sound in a healthy way, be able to project your voice, obviously, in different halls of different sizes. And yes, Rossini is particular because there are a heck of a lot of notes to sing. But it all comes down to your technique and the fluidity of your individual voice and whether it works or not for Rossini. I know lots of colleagues who say, oh, I find this really hard to do, or I'm not really a fan of singing Rossini because my coloratura isn't that great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it could just be, you know, we could boil it down to animalistic. It's neither a good or a bad thing. It's just what it is. And for those of us who like to sing Rossini, just in the actual doing of it, that in itself is a training. And you become more and more familiar with the tricks and turns of Rossini and his writing, and also the ways in which make it easier for you to sing it for any individual singer. You know, so we all have different cadenzas and different patterns that our voices sing more rapidly or more cleanly. You know, so we have. It's still all very individual. So even though there may be a large group of people that can sing Rossini, everybody does it quite differently.
Well, what do you look for when you're looking at particular roles? Is it the musicality of it, or do you really consider character and story as part of that as well?
I would say that I actually consider the story and the character first. And, you know, text, story, and the theater of it is what's most interesting to me. I really enjoy telling a story. I really enjoy the theater, the interpersonal relationships between characters. And it's not to say that the music is secondary or in a sub position, but it does, it comes slightly after. I mean, I won't sing a role where I feel that the character is not something that will work for me. And generally speaking, so far, I've been lucky that the characters and the music, of course, have come hand in hand, and everything has been really, really fun and really wonderful. But definitely the text, the story.
Well, you have a new album coming up with a great story behind it, I think. It's an adaptation of Dr. Seuss's Gertrude McFuzz, and composer Rob Capello, who's written a Seuss adaptation before, Green Eggs and Ham, many years ago. I remember being introduced to his music through that. And you have a young son.
I do.
Did he play any role in inspiring this collaboration?
Well, luckily I don't have to consult my son yet for what jobs I take. I do, however, have to explain to him that I have to go to work if he actually wants toys in the house. But no, I had received an email from Glenn Rovin who said, hey, you know, we're doing this recording. Would you like to do it? And I said, absolutely. Dr. Seuss, that sounds perfect. Because, of course, I've read probably every Dr. Seuss story to my son already.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a great, great project to work on. Both Glenn Rovin and his recording company and Rob Capello are so fun. And we had a great time in the recording studio.
And the music is a lot of fun because it's very Broadway-like, it's very jazzy, and it's very funny, too. And I love the way you kind of draw out comically some of the words, like bird in one case. That made me laugh out loud.
Oh, good. I had a lot of fun with that. I was able to manipulate in the best of ways my voice in a healthy way. I have to say that in case, you know, my teacher's listening. Yes, like you said, there are some elements of musical theater. There's a little bit of what we would say, you know, classical singing. But, you know, to bring it down to its most base, it is just singing, you know, it is singing in all versions of what the voice can do. And that's really what I'm into. You know, I think it's so important to remember, not only individually, but as a culture, that we've been singing for centuries, and it is an animalistic, raw, beautiful thing. And whether you're a classical opera singer, a pop star, a jazz singer, a country singer, whatever, good singing is good singing. And we as a society recognize it at the drop of a hat. You know, somebody comes out and sings something and is connected and soulful, whatever the genre, and everybody goes quiet. And so that's what's really important to me. And I hope that the fun, you know, medium of Gertrude McFuzz was able to bring a little bit of that to kids particularly.
Well, I wanted to know, because you sound like a real musical omnivore as well. And so what made you decide you wanted to pursue music as a vocation? At what point in your younger days did you say, you know what, this is performance and singing and music is what I want to do?
You know, I knew from a young age that I wanted to be a part of the theater. I wasn't sure at the time what that meant exactly, or whether it would be dance or theater or singing or what have you. But I did know that I had an attraction to being in a show, you know, on the theater in a play. And it evolved somewhat naturally on its own, step by step, going to dance class and music school and conservatory. And I decided to go to Juilliard because I wanted to make sure I had nailed my technique by the time I finished my school, because that in my mind meant that I could then still choose what I wanted to do with my voice. And I'm, you know, of course I'm very much entrenched in the opera world, and it's my first love, so to speak. That's where I have been able to get my wings, and you know, but my voice, I feel I'd love to do all sorts of different things, you know.
Well, last question, if I may, kind of a goofy question, I guess. I was reading some of your reviews online, and I love that when reviewers use adjectives that they're, you know, they seem to be plucking out in order to describe, you know, voice and technique and everything. And the New York Times described you as plush and animated, and that review on your website is placed right above a YouTube video of you on Sesame Street. I thought that was quite appropriate. Yeah. Did they write that before or after your appearance there?
I have no idea. I try really hard not to read reviews in general. And if I do, that's well after it was probably published. So I'm the last person to know when something came out. But Sesame Street was a lot of fun. That was a highlight.
Yeah, I understand it is for pretty much every musician that appears on the show.
Oh, it's just, I mean, it's a staple of our culture. It's just, it's incredible. It's incredible.
Isabel Leonard, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And it's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Oh, no. Thanks very much. My pleasure completely.